Hey.
Hi there.
How are you?
I'm fine.
So, tell me a little about yourself. First of all, you know, what's your name? What do you do?
So my name is Stefan T. Lowade, and I am the newest developer on the Visual C++ Libraries team. I joined last year.
Okay. Interesting. And what are you working on?
Right now I'm working on TR1, but in the past I've also worked on various standard template library bug fixes.
Nice.
Yeah.
So how long have you been a C++ programmer?
Coming on 6-7 years now.
Yeah.
I started around January 2002, so I guess it makes it 6 years.
Excellent. What got you in?
And then a year and a half of C before that.
Oh, man. So you miss C at all?
No.
Yeah. So what got you into C++ anyway?
Well, actually, in the midst of time, I started with QBasic because it was what I had on my DOS machines.
Okay.
Of course, it was incredibly limited. And when I was in like middle school, I was always interested in things like SHA-1 hashes and data compression.
You were in middle school?
Things like that. Yeah, and random number generation or whatever. Of course, I couldn't do any of it.
Yeah.
Knowing only QBasic, but I was interested in learning about things like that.
Interesting.
And so, you know, I'd always had these interests, you know, going into high school, and I just didn't know how to program. I even wrote things like RSA encryption on my TI calculator, which had a version of BASIC, and it's such a horrible language for doing any advanced work. Mm-hmm. So once I graduated high school, I said, you know, it can't be that hard. I'm just going to teach myself C. So I got myself a copy of the KNR2, Kernighan and Ritchie's The C Programming Language, and started teaching myself C. It was very hard because I was doing it, you know, entirely by myself, and I wasn't exactly using the best beginner's book in the world. So I was very confused for a long time about things like separate compilation. Pointers never gave me any trouble. Many people have trouble with pointers. I never did. But things like separate source files confused the crap out of me for a very long time. And so eventually, after, you know, a year, I tried to write a program that actually managed memory, you know, allocating to allocate memory. At the time, I wanted to compress ping images better. Mm. And, of course, you'd need to allocate memory to store the image and manipulate it and whatever. And that program never worked. It just crashed all the time.
Huh.
And so once I saw the limitations of the language like that, I started looking at C++, which before that point I had rejected as, C++ is, you know, a big, grotesque language. It's suitable only for, you know, large projects. I'm a hobbyist programmer. I only write small to medium projects. I don't need that. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I started to see how C made memory management just insanely difficult to do by hand, mm-hmm. I started to look at C++, and I actually picked it up very rapidly. And since then, I haven't looked back. So that's really how I got started. And, of course, when I was in college, I was, you know, writing programs on my own to, you know, teach myself the language. I went to Caltech, the California Institute of Technology.
Yeah.
Which is a great CS school, but actually not so great for programming. They're very much into the theory side of things.
Mm.
And in fact, they cut out C++ from their introductory programming classes entirely. It used to be that you know, their whole sequence was, you know, based around C and C++. But by the time I got there, they had restructured their beginning courses to be based around Scheme and Java. So I actually did 4 years of Scheme, 1 year of learning as a student, then 3 years of TAing it. So I had a very strong functional background in that sense. But I had never done a whole lot of formal programming. I had, like, 3 workshop courses on C and C++, which were very good.
Mm-hmm.
But with only, you know, like, 3 credits, that's a third of a normal course. So my formal exposure to the language wasn't very big before I got here and then started, you know, writing C++ full-time.
Sure.
So I really, my background is a hobbyist programmer. And I continue writing programs for fun, teaching myself more and more of the language and trying to keep up with things.
Outstanding. Well, do you spend any time writing functional programs?
Yes. One of the great things about C++ is that it is, now the usual word for it is multi-paradigm. And it's kind of a horrible word because paradigm is so overused, but it's really the only word that is suitable here. It's a multi-paradigm programming language, meaning that C++ doesn't try to force you into one way of writing programs. Other languages come at you saying, oh, we know the best way to write programs. We're going to provide you lots and lots of tools to work within this one narrow way. But if you want to do something else, you know, you're out of luck. C++ says, you know, hey, it's up to you, the programmer. Don't get yourself in trouble. We're going to, you know, support as many ways of programming as we can imagine that are safe in the hands of a skilled practitioner. So that's why you end up with C++ supporting imperative-style programming, object-oriented programming, generic programming, now functional programming, and, of course, low-level, down-to-the-metal programming. And you can write a program that contains all these different things. So, for example, a game could have, you know, generally be programmed in perhaps an object-oriented style, but rely on generic libraries, have functional parts that interact with the generic libraries, and then contain low-level code for, you know, graphics or whatever.
Interesting. So, I mean, what do you mean functional programming in C++?
So, when people usually say functional, they're thinking of languages like Lisp and Scheme. And the defining characteristic of these languages is that they consider functions to be first-class objects. And this is not the case in C. In C, functions are totally different from objects that you manipulate. If you look at the standard, the definition of an object is something that requires storage. So like an int is an object in the C sense of the word, or a double, or a pointer. They're all things that you can, you know, malloc memory for and then write some bits. A function isn't like that. It's compiled into code, and you can't manipulate. Now, you do have function pointers. So you can allow for things like functions to be selected at runtime, but they're definitely not first-class objects in the usual sense of the term. In C, you can't do something like construct a lambda function on the fly and then go pass that to some other meta function. Now, C++, you know, started as C and then, you know, got classes, C with classes, and then just snowballed from there. So it comes from a history that doesn't support functions as first-class objects. But over the years, it's gained enough expressiveness so that you can pretend that functions are first-class objects. And this is a pretty cool trick. Some people might find it verbose, like many C++ tricks, but it's powerful nevertheless. So the idea in C++ is that, okay, you still can't manipulate functions as first-class objects, but you can define a class that implements operator parenthesis parenthesis, the function call operator. And such a class acts a lot like a function. You can have an object of that class and then say that object's name, foo, and then parenthesis, and then some arguments, and then end parenthesis, and you can call the object with those arguments. And what that is doing is invoking the function call operator on that object. And so then you can do something like take that object and pass it around. You can give that object as an argument to an algorithm, like, say, the STL's COUNTIF or SORT, and then the algorithm will use that object on whatever elements or other things it's comparing or testing or whatever. So it allows you to customize the behavior of an algorithm in much the same way that you would customize the behavior of a function in Scheme by passing it another lambda function to manipulate it on the fly. Now, in C++, it's not immediately easy to just write a little, you know, half of a line of a function object. Usually you do need to go outside your function and write, you know, five lines of a very simple struct or a standalone function that you can then pass around. But that's not conceptual complexity. It's only syntax complexity, and Tier 1 helps to address some of that by allowing you to define and manipulate more of these function objects or functors on the fly.
Outstanding. So you said the key word, TR1. So what the hell is it?
So one of the things that's always important to keep in mind is that everyone has schedule pressure. They all have ship dates they need to meet.
Sure.
And this is true even in the case of the C++ standard. So they started the process of standardization, I think, in the early 90s. You know, codifying this language that had just been growing like mad with people just adding features, many diverse implementations, including ours. So they were trying to, okay, standardize existing practice, invent some new practice to fix problems with the language, things like that. And one of the things they really wanted to do was ship a standard in the 20th century. And it was taking a long time, because C++ is a very big, very complex language, because it supports so many modes of expression. You've got all these different features that are interacting, and that makes the definition of the language quite complex. And then you've got a standard library, too, that has to play nicely with all these core language features. So they incorporated the STL, the Standard Template Library, around 94, and that actually pushed the standard back by a whole year. And it was eventually standardized in 1998, just barely by the end of the century. And although they got the STL in, they weren't able to get as many features into the library as they wanted. For example, one of the things that's entirely missing from the 98 standard is hash tables or hash containers. They're a very common thing to implement in a library, and they're very useful, but there just wasn't time to specify them in a rigorous enough manner that they were comfortable shipping them in the standard. So they were just cut. Plenty of other things were implemented, but not in a very convenient form in the standard, just because there wasn't enough time, and also in many cases because we didn't know any better. There's many things in the standard like auto pointer, bind first, bind second, that are in the standard, and people thought they were useful and thought they solved problems, and they did, but they were quite limited and hard to use. And with basically a decade of experience since then, we know better now, and we can write libraries still using the 98 core language, but that are more powerful, more easier to use, more expressive. And that's what TR1 is. So once that 98 standard was released, a bunch of the standardization committee members looked at all the wonderful features they had cut and all the features they wanted to write and didn't have time for, and they said, why do we have to wait for the next standard? Because C++ is about on a 10-year ship cycle. Why do we have to wait for the next standard to come out? We're going to run into the same problem where we have a bunch of cool ideas and there just isn't time, because the committee is run by a bunch of volunteers. They all work for, many of them work for corporations, but their work for the committee is generally volunteer. So although there's a lot of committee members, unlike other languages, which are only driven by one or two people, still time is a finite resource. So these committee members said, why don't we get a head start on this? And what they did is they started an open source library project called Boost. And Boost is basically a collection of sub-libraries. So someone will independently write a library and then propose it for addition into Boost. Mm-hmm. And then these library experts from around the world will review it, suggest ways that it can be improved, and then either accept it or reject it, in which case they might work on it some more and then resubmit it in the future. So over the years, Boost has been accumulating a lot of very useful C++ libraries that are very high quality because they've been implemented and designed by the world experts in library programming and C++ in general. And so now that the committee is starting to work on the next C++ standard called C++OX, they've gone back and looked at these Boost libraries, which were started, although not entirely implemented, by the committee members themselves, and said, okay, which of these do we want to incorporate into C++OX? And many of them were polished enough and useful enough that they did make the cut and became incorporated into OX. But then they also said, Boost is the only implementation of the things that we've got. But we have many C++ vendors. Like, we're a vendor of a compiler and library. There are others who maintain C++ compilers. If these are going to be in the standard, maybe we want a little more bake time on these things. So what the committee did is basically a community technology preview of these libraries that they're adding to the next standard. Mm. So they released a document called the Technical Report 1 that specifies a set of libraries that are implementable using the existing standard but will appear in the next standard, with more features, of course. And so TR1 is like an extra pack of libraries that you can add to any existing C++ 98 compiler and take advantage of there. And this is pretty useful for a number of reasons. First is the users. Users get to benefit from it immediately rather than waiting for the next standard. It's also useful to implementers like us who maintain a compiler, because we get to write these libraries now, work all the bugs out so that the eventual C++ OX versions of them will be more robust. And it's also useful to the committee themselves, because if problems are found in the TR1 spec itself, they can go fix them in the next language standard. And in fact, there are problems being found. I found a couple myself.
Interesting. So let's talk about some of the big ones. What are some of the big innovations that exist in TR1 from a library point of view?
Okay, well, TR1, like Boost, and like the standard library in general, is a collection of sub-libraries. So one of the things that the standard does is C++'s standard library is very different from other languages' standard libraries. If you look at other languages, I won't name any, they tend to say, hey, we are going to give you a huge standard library. Whatever you can think of, we're going to provide it for you. All you need to do is pick and choose. So you're basically looking for off-the-shelf components. Now, C++ is used by programmers who are generally the experts in their fields, and it's used in so many different domains: network programming, games, compilers, operating systems, applications, email, servers, whatever.
Virtual machines.
Yes, virtual machines, things that weren't even thought of at the time that the standard was produced. That there just isn't enough space in a standard library to do all of these things. And even if they tried, they wouldn't do it that well, because the solutions would never be targeted enough and performant enough and flexible enough to meet every developer's needs. So continuing with the tradition of, you know, giving the programmer tools to write their own solutions, the C++ standard library aims to provide flexible and general tools that can then be used to build specific components. If you look at something like the STL, the standard template library, it's a bunch of generic containers and algorithms. It doesn't care what types you're going to make containers of. It doesn't care how you're going to customize its algorithms. They're very general and very powerful. So what TR1 does is it's a collection of libraries that sort of seems ad hoc, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but they all have sort of a unifying focus of making the STL, the existing standard library, easier to use. And they also generally implement functionality that is very convenient to use as a user, but very difficult to roll yourself. So like the Tier 1 falls into three different categories. The first category is the components that were derived from Boost itself. And then the second category is components that weren't derived from Boost. They actually exist for compatibility with C99. So in the intervening decade, a whole new C standard has been developed. The original was 1989. Now there's a new C standard, 1999, that brings things like the 64-bit type long, a bunch of other math functions, things like that, new headers. And so although C++ 98 isn't based on this C standard, which was then in the future, C++ OX will be generally compatible with C99. So TR1 brings a bunch of headers that increase compatibility with C99. So like the standard int header that provides fixed length type defs. So also some functions to deal with the long type, which by now even our compiler implements as an extension to C++ 98 because it's so useful. And then the third component of TR1 is called the special math functions. These are things like your hypergeometric function and your Legendre polynomial and your Riemann zeta function, things that you need a PhD to understand but are very useful if you're in the scientific engineering disciplines that require those sort of things. And obviously, they're not the kind of functions that everyone wants to write for themselves.
Sure.
And they're also very difficult to get right.
Yeah.
What we're shipping in the Visual C++ 2008 feature pack is just the Boost-derived components, which are sort of the most broadly useful of the three big tier 1 components. The C99 compatibility functions have been voted into C++ OX. Mm-hmm. So eventually we'll get them with the C++ OX standard library. But we don't really have time now to ship that. And it's also, while useful, not as broadly useful as the Boost-derived components. And the special math functions are of limited interest, and they haven't even been voted, actually, into the OX standard. So we're not shipping them now either.
Interesting. So let's take a look at some of this.
Okay. I can show you some code examples if you want.
Yeah. And, you know, continue talking on. But okay. It's always fun to get it on the whiteboard.
So let me see. I'm going to list the components that from memory. So I remember what to talk about.
Yep, shared pointer. That'll be an interesting one to talk about.
And there's containers. And there's type trays. And then there's reference wrapper. So, the first and probably most popular component is shared pointer. If you ask me, and also if you ask the C++ community in general, shared pointer is the most important part of TR1. If you read recent C++ books like Effective C++ Third Edition by Scott Myers or C++ Coding Standards by our own Herb Sutter and Andre Alexandrescu, they're all in agreement that shared pointer is the most useful part of Boost and TR1. And the reason why is actually very, very deep, very fundamental. And it has to do with the problem of resource management. And this is actually a very difficult problem that strikes all programming languages. So it's useful to step back and think, okay, what is a resource? And what does it mean to manage it? So a resource is anything that you need to acquire from the system, and then use it, party on it, and then at some point in the future, release it back to the system. You can't be endlessly accumulating resources because you're going to run out, and that would be bad.
Yes.
Or you're going to monopolize it for other people. So the most common example of a resource is memory. You allocate memory from the system. We only have so many sticks of RAM in our machine, and at some point you need to give it back or we're going to run out, even with virtual memory. We don't run out, but then we start thrashing the disk, and that's not good. So we do want to give back memory as soon as possible. But then there's also non-memory resources. And these are the more interesting resources because they behave differently.
Yeah.
My usual examples of non-memory resources are files, sockets, locks, textures, HDCs, fonts, HWINs, whatever that you need to specifically allocate from the system or acquire from the system, and then you go use them somehow, and then you need to release them. And usually you want to release these very quickly once you're done with them. For example, if you hold on to a file too long, now no one else can delete it or move it. Or if you hold on to a texture too long, it's clogging up space in the video card. And that's very bad if you start transferring textures from main memory. You don't want to be holding on to too many fonts or HDCs because there's finite system resources backing those. So if you look at, and every language has different ways of managing resources. The simplest and the oldest is C's sort of fundamental way of managing everything, which is to say, hey, programmer, you get to do all of it by hand. Mm-hmm. And while it is possible to write working programs with manual resource management, it's also very difficult. As decades of suffering have taught us, manual resource management is associated with all sorts of problems. You got your leaks, memory leaks, other resource leaks are even worse. Imagine never freeing a file or never getting rid of a texture. And then you've got your errors, like double free errors, allocating an array and then freeing only the first element, things like that. So manual resource management, bad idea. In fact, that's what propelled me to go from C to C++. Mm. If you look at many other languages, their solution to this is garbage collection. And garbage collection takes the opposite approach, saying, you, the programmer, we don't trust you with resource management, so we're going to do it all for you. As soon as we detect that you're not using an object anymore, we're just going to get rid of it at some unspecified point in the future. Mm-hmm. So basically, all the deletes in your source vanish. But you still got all those news in your source. And that seems like a really good idea at first. But there's a bunch of problems with it. Not only the practical problems, like it destroys locality, because now you're allocating a bunch of objects, always doing dynamic allocation. You're no longer contiguous in memory, and that really doesn't play nice with modern caching systems. And it also wreaks havoc with memory space usage, because if you try to get reasonable performance, you're not going to be running the garbage collector all the time. So you can either have decent performance but consuming 7 times the memory of a manual solution, or you can have about the same space usage but vastly decreased performance. Aside from those practical problems, there's also the fundamental problem of non-memory resources. What if you have a file or something in an object and you get rid of your last reference to it? Well, if you allow the GC to come in and clean up that file object whenever it feels like, until it does so, that file is going to remain open. That's not good. Or you can try to address the problem with finalizers and things like that, but they're incredibly complicated. There's many problems with them, especially relating around references becoming live after some point. And, yeah, there's a lot of problems there. So what C++ does is it comes at it...
That's called resurrection, by the way.
Resurrection, okay. Yeah. I'm not actually very familiar with managed languages, so I don't know the very specifics of how garbage collection is bad. But I've seen enough of its problems to not want anything to do with it. Now, I'm not opposed to garbage collection for specific types.
Sure.
It's universal garbage collection, saying everything you allocate will be GC'd, that I have a problem with.
And that's true for most C++ programmers.
Yes. Usually, the people who think otherwise have moved on to other languages by now.
True.
But the people who are still using C++ are the experts who really care about details like, hey, when is this file getting freed? They care about the memory usage of their programs and the efficiency. So C++, coming at it from the C history, still retains the option of manual resource management. If you really want to, yes, you can new and delete, array new and array delete everything. Mm-hmm. But because C++ has been adding higher-level abstractions, it has another way of doing resource management. And as far as I can tell, this is unique to C++. No other language has this because they all either take C's way of doing it or the garbage collection way of doing it. So what C++ says is it takes a very object-oriented approach to resource management, but this isn't the usual meaning of OOP. When I say OOP, usually I mean inheritance. You've got your base class, your drive class, and the usual set of techniques that go around there. But another thing that object-oriented programming means is really data encapsulation. You've got an object which both provides services or member functions and retains state or contains data members. And what C++ says is, hey, you've got this perfectly encapsulated object. You have ways to initialize it into a coherent state, a constructor, which will take dead bits and transform them into a living object. Mm-hmm. I'm going to supply the reverse, which is a destructor, which will take a living object and tear it down into non-living bits, which can then be returned to the system. So what C++ does is encapsulate resource release in the form of a destructor. So in the C++ world, if you want to manage a resource, you write an object that encapsulates the resource. Its constructor will acquire the resource. So it's either going to new up memory or open a file or get a texture from DirectX or OpenGL or whatever. And then it has member functions that will allow you to manipulate the resource. Write bits in your allocated block of memory, transform the texture, write to the file, or read from the file. And then its destructor will release the resource. So it'll delete the memory, it will close the file, release the texture to the system. It does the opposite of whatever the constructor does. Mm-hmm. And so this is generally called RAII, which is a very unwieldy acronym. And some people say RAI, but generally I will pronounce each letter individually. And it means resource acquisition is initialization. And that's to remind you that if you're acquiring a resource, you should give that responsibility to a constructor. And one thing that RAI implies is RRID. I first read this in a book called Imperfect C++. It doesn't seem to be very popular, but the acronym I find is very useful to think about. RRID means resource release is destruction. It's the flip side. So many people sometimes write helper classes that implement RRID. They need to do something at the end of a block, so they'll give that responsibility to a constructor. RAII is more general, saying not only will the destructor do something, but we're going to encapsulate the entire lifetime of the resource, bracketed by the constructor and the destructor. So one reason RAII is so useful in C++ is because it has what I call, or what many people call, comprehensive creation destruction semantics. And what that mouthful means is that every object in C++ has been constructed at some point in the past and will be destroyed at some point in the future, barring any horrible programmer mistakes. So, for example, if you have a local block, you've got open brace, some code, and then close brace, any automatic objects, like an X named X here, when you leave that scope, those automatic objects or local objects will be destroyed. And it doesn't matter how you leave the scope. You can either exit normally as the control flow passes through, you can either have a return statement somewhere inside the block, or you can have a throw. So if you exit by throwing an exception, yes, you've exited that scope, so the local objects will be destroyed. Mm-hmm. You can also have member objects of class. So if you have a class K, and then it contains some private members A and B, whenever the K is destroyed, perhaps by exiting an automatic block, the members A and B will be destroyed, because in K's constructor, the A and then the B are constructed. So it's always the reverse, the teardown. Similarly, if you have, say, a vector, say, of this K object, name in V, then when the vector is destroyed, perhaps because it's an automatic vector or it's a member of some other class, when the vector gets destroyed, it will go through and destroy all of its individual K elements. So as long as you don't do anything terrible, programmer mistakes, and notice that this is the opposite of the C way of doing things. In C, you must always remember to do certain things. If you malloc up something, you must remember to free it, and you must remember not to double free it. And that's very hard to see at just by looking at the source. How do you know that the control flow taken will be one that matches up every malloc with every free? Well, in general, you don't. And in practice, programmers get it wrong all the time. With
this sort of resource management style, you need to be careful not to do certain things, like new up something and give ownership of that to a raw pointer. Because if you say t pointer p equals new, you know, whatever, some t, or then this is a raw pointer. It is not encapsulated. So raw pointers technically have destructors if you look at the standard, but they're no ops. They don't do anything. So if you were to then throw an exception, throw whatever, the exception flies out, and yes, this pointer is destroyed, but the pointer is just a bundle of bits. So its destructor doesn't do anything, and you've just leaked this memory.
Uh-huh.
If you say this, you violated RAII because you've acquired a resource by newing something up, but you have not initialized an object with a destructor with it. Oops. So if you throw, or even just return normally, but through a path that you forgot to have a corresponding delete with, then you've leaked your memory.
Mm.
So as long as you always give ownership of resources to objects and then compose bigger objects with those smaller objects, you're going to just entirely free yourself from the problems of leaks and double frees and other problems like that. And so, so you've got these automatic scopes.
Yep.
You've got members of objects. You've got containers, STL containers of objects. So what containers do is they enable one object, the vector, owning many sub-objects, the elements.
Mm.
But what this doesn't permit you is many owning one. For example, say that you want, you've got three places in your code or three objects that want to collectively share ownership of some object that's going to be dynamically allocated. And you want it to go away when the last of those three owners is destroyed. But you don't want to make copies of the object. You want to have a single object memory. There's no way to do this using existing standard library components. So Tier 1 provides this thing called shared pointer. And shared pointer is really cool. Let me erase some of this. Because it is a non-intrusive reference-counted smart pointer that plays well with RAII. So I can write shared pointer to any object like X, call it SP, and I can give it ownership of a newly dynamically allocated object. So some new X, and then maybe I have some args, you know, 10, 20, something like this. So what this does is this news up an X in memory. Well, it allocates memory for the X and then constructs an X object inside it. It stores, you know, 10 and 20. Who knows what the representation of the X is. And then it constructs a shared pointer named SP that owns the X object. And when the shared pointer is destroyed, if it's the last owner of the X, it will then destroy the X object. And as usual, this will happen no matter how the shared pointer is destroyed, because you return from a function and it's local in scope, or because it's an element of container that's destroyed, or because you've thrown an exception, that object is going to be released, which is different than giving ownership of it to a raw pointer, where you've got to manually match it up with a delete and make sure you don't double delete it and the usual problems there.
Sure.
So if you got your shared pointer to an X, you can then copy it. So you can say, you know, shared pointer to X named SP2 and make a copy of SP. So shared pointer is an ordinary value type. It's copyable, it's assignable, it behaves just like an int would. So if you copy that into SP2, it does what the name says, and it shares ownership. And now, if SP is destroyed, or perhaps it's simply assigned, reset to own something else, if it goes away, it loses its ownership on X, but the X remains around because SP2 still owns it. Only when SP2 is finally destroyed, perhaps by throwing an exception or whatever, then the X will be destroyed. And this is because shared pointer is a reference-counted smart pointer.
Nice.
Now, when people hear reference counting, often the first thing they think of is garbage collection, because reference counting is often used to implement garbage collectors. But shared pointer, although it uses reference counting, is not garbage collected. It's deterministically reference counted, meaning that it maintains a count of how many shared pointers are owning an X. When that count hits zero, then the object is destroyed.
But it's destroyed automatically by the runtime.
Yes.
Let's talk about that.
It's destroyed automatically like anything else with a destructor. So what Tier 1 is not doing is adding any sort of runtime process that's always in the background scanning for all the instances of shared pointers like a garbage collector would. Instead, shared pointer simply has a destructor like any other C++ type that when the shared pointer is destroyed, it's going to look at the ref count. It's going to decrement it, and then it's going to check, okay, is this ref count zero? No, then I'm just not going to do anything. Or, yes, the ref count has hit zero, I will then go delete the X.
Sure.
So there is a runtime component to it, but that's just the destructor running. So you're guaranteed that when the last shared pointer to an object dies, the object itself will be destroyed right then and there. So no overheads, none of that. And you're getting this dynamic memory management in a very controlled fashion. You don't have to allocate all your types with new, just the ones that you want to manage through shared pointer. Ordinary value types, you can still put them on the stack in containers as a member of other objects. And you can do the same thing with shared pointer. You can have them on the stack. You can have them as members of other objects, or you can have containers as shared pointer, which is one of the most useful and powerful idioms that I've found for dealing with objects. Because, in fact, there are many X types that are non-copyable. Examples are resource managers. If you have a file object, what would it mean to copy that object? Does it make a copy of the file? Does it copy just a handle to the file? Ordinarily, you don't want to decide one way or the other, so you're going to make the object non-copyable, and that's what is done for the input file stream from the standard library. Same with output file stream and just F string. They're non-copyable because it's not clear what would happen if you copy an F string object. Another very important class of types which are non-copyable are polymorphic objects. So if I have a base object, and then I have a derived object, which publicly derives from base. Now, this is something that many C++ programmers, when they're beginning, don't understand immediately, is that if they simply have a class base that's instantiable, it's a concrete class, and then they define a class derived, which is also instantiable, it's another concrete class, and they don't do anything special, they are creating the opportunity for a horrible bug in their code. That bug is slicing. So one of the things about inheritance is that anything the base can do, the derived needs to be able to do. This is a, and it says that every derived is a base. So if I can do something with the base, I'd better be able to do it with the derived. That's just substitutability. It's usually a good thing.
Sure.
The problem is that if you allow copying, you can copy one base to another, just like you can copy one int to another. Then that interacts with derived objects in a very bad way. Say that you have a function, you know, function f, that takes a base b by value. Okay, so if you pass in a base, its state gets copied into f, and then f goes and parties on it, b dot whatever, maybe modifies it, does something else. Now, suppose that you call f like so. You make a derived d, and then you call f of d. Can this compile? You're not giving it the exact type it asked for, but a derived can be viewed as a base. So it has a base component. So this call will succeed, and what will happen is that only the base part of the derived object will be copied into F. This is called slicing, because you've lost whatever derived state it has. And when this B, when functions are invoked on this B, the derived implementations won't be called. That's very bad. So ordinarily, you don't want slicing, but you want to preserve substitutability. So what you do is you say, okay, this base is going to be non-copyable. I'm going to make its copy constructor and copy assignment operator private and unimplemented, which is the usual way to make objects non-copyable in C++ 9.8. There's a better way coming in OX. And in that case, if it's non-copyable, then you can't do this. You have to pass by pointer. Pointers are fine because you're referring to the same object and your derived base pointer conversions are okay. But if you're now newing up your polymorphic objects and accessing them by pointer, you've got the usual resource management problems. So what you can do is you can make a shared pointer to base and hold your objects of polymorphic type in that shared pointer. Mm. And here's the best part. You can create vectors or other STL containers of shared pointers to base. This allows you to do something pretty cool. If you write... You've got your vector of shared pointer to base, v. So then I can do something like v pushback. suppose that I've got a function that returns a shared pointer to derived, taking some int n, and it is going to eventually return a shared pointer to a newly constructed derived. I can do v push back make derived, same thing but with 20 here. And maybe I have another class called, you know, more derived, and I have another function. This would be called make derived here. Suppose I have another class called more derived. Well, I could do v dot pushback make more derived. Perhaps this isn't constructed from a int, but it's constructed from a string. This works fine, and this is really neat. So we've got our, what this does is this vector v, this is a vector shared pointers to base. So it contains a bunch of guys, and all these elements are shared pointers. So this first shared pointer, it's a shared pointer to base, but what it actually points to is a derived object containing 10. The second shared pointer is also a pointer to a derived object containing 20, and the third one points to a more derived of a completely different type that still inherits from base that contains the string A. Then you can go through and iterate on this vector and call, say, some virtual member function of all these objects. And it will invoke the correct derived, derived, and more derived member function of each of its elements. And then when the vector is destroyed, each of the shared pointers will be destroyed if these are the last owners of the objects, which in general it will be unless you've gone and copied them elsewhere. Then the destructors for these guys will be invoked, and if it's got a virtual destructor, which it should, then the correct destructor will be invoked. Shared pointer is actually super sneaky, and it allows you to do this even when you don't have a virtual destructor. It contains enough machinery to get that right. In general, any polymorphic type would have a virtual destructor, so that doesn't come into play.
Interesting.
So this is useful in a bunch of scenarios.
Sure.
I've not used very good examples here with base and derive, but for example, you could have a vector of objects to render, and you could have an individual object like a window, another one a spaceship, another one a score, and then you just iterate through and then you draw all these things on a screen. Or perhaps you have a vector of employees, to use a very old example. Some employees are ICs, some employees are managers. You need to all have them do some specific thing implemented by a virtual function, which is very difficult to do if you're doing this all with raw pointers. Because, yes, you could have a vector of base pointer v, but then you have a very big problem if you throw an exception and you forget to delete all of the objects contained by the v. This is something beginning programmers with the STL run into all the time, because sometimes they think that raw pointers will delete the objects they own, and they don't. Shared pointer is the correct way to handle that.
Okay. So let's. There's also another type of pointer, safe pointers, that we talked with Ale. I talked about that.
Sometime. Are those managed code?
Maybe they were. I'm not sure.
They sure sound like it. They're used to interact with finalizers and things like that.
Okay, probably.
Okay. In the native world, there are, in the C++ standard world, there's actually a lot of smart pointers. In addition to all the ones that people like to roll themselves, most of which contain horrible but unrecognized flaws.
Okay.
We're Microsoft. We like to implement everything. So we've got like at least 5 different implementations of smart pointers here. I've looked at most of them, and they all contain flaws. The nice thing about shared pointer is that it's such an easy thing to think of, but hard to get right in the exact details. And over time, they've worked out all the jagged metal edges in shared pointer.
Nice.
So one of the things that people will write if they're writing a smart pointer for the first time is, what they want is they want to declare my smart pointer to whatever, name P. Then they go fill it with maybe some stuff, maybe some not, and then they want to check, okay, does this P have anything? So they want to write if P, like you do with a raw pointer, or maybe if not P, or maybe if P and something else. Well, ordinarily you can't test an object of class type. The compiler say, whoa, I don't know what that means. So what people will do is, inside the MySmartPointer definition, well, if it needs to be convertible to a bool, we will simply write operator bool. And then inside that will just return whether its internal pointer is not equal to zero. Well, this works. This allows code like this and this to compile. But it's psychotically dangerous. And this is something that many people do not appreciate. Huh. Because this allows you to have, you know, my smart pointer P. And then it allows code like this to compile. Crazy stuff. How can you multiply a smart pointer by 5? If it points to a single object, you really don't want to be adding 5 to it. And how can you divide a smart pointer by 5? Yet all these will compile if you implement operator bool. And this is because C++ says, hey, you're the programmer. You know what you're doing. I'm just the compiler slash language. I don't know anything. I'm not sentient. So if you write some code, I'm going to try my darndest to compile it. Mm-hmm. And it's going to apply as many techniques in its arsenal as it can to get your code to compile. Because fundamentally, it's benevolent. It's not. It wants to compile whatever you're writing. Mm-hmm. So if you provide an operator bool, and then you write something like this, what the compiler will say is, oh, I don't know how to multiply an object of class type by 5. Okay, well, I'm going to look at all of the conversion operators that the class type implements. Hey, look, there's this one here called operator bool. What happens if I apply it? Okay, well, then I don't get P. I either get 0 or I get 1. Mm-hmm. Hey, look there. Now, technically, that's not right. I've got my P here, and then I apply this operator bool. I get either true or false using a single user-defined conversion. Then I can apply a standard conversion of true to 1 or false to 0. And hey, look, now I have an int. I can multiply an int by 5. Okay, so this will either give you 0 or 5. Mm-hmm. And this will either give you 5 or 6, and so forth. And yes, it compiled, but that's totally not the result the programmer wanted. And then there's other problems with these things.
Sure.
Other things that people will try to write are, okay, well, bools are bad. I'm going to write operator void pointer. This is probably even worse. What shared pointer does is it uses a certain library technique. It's convertible to a pointer to member type, which is then convertible to bool, yes or no. And that pointer to member type is useless. It's not usable for anything else. So it provides correctness and safety at the cost of an inscrutable implementation. But hey, you don't have to look at the shared pointer header.
Hmm. So use shared pointer.
Yes, use shared pointer. Basically, the principle is that every new bracket, the array new in your source, mm-hmm. should be already gone. You should have replaced this already with vector. Vector is a container. It implements RAII because when a vector is destroyed, it's going to nuke all of its elements. It's much more powerful because it'll automatically reallocate. It has iterators, things like that. So no array new in your source already. Any news in your source, scalar news, should immediately be handed off to a shared pointer because the shared pointer implements RAII, and when it's destroyed, it'll nuke whatever it is owning. And it plays nice with derived-based conversions, const correctness, all the usual. And you can put it inside STL containers. And then every delete statement in your source should vanish, because the shared pointer will do that implicitly. The only exceptions to this are basically two. One is if you're implementing a new data structure that shared pointer and vector and things like that aren't suitable for. So if you're implementing a tree or something else, or maybe a super custom hash table, then yes, you may need to fall back to the lowest level and use news and even scalar news. Assuming that you match them up with deletes and array deletes, and you don't expose these internals to anyone else. The other case, of course, is performance. So if performance absolutely matters, you cannot tolerate the reference count in the shared pointer, then okay, you can fall back to the bare metal. But in general, if you're writing high-level code, you should be using things like STL vectors and TR1 shared pointers, because they're safer, they're more robust, and they're almost as efficient as the handwritten code. Hmm. Sometimes even more efficient. Because if you're just rolling something by yourself, you can introduce horrible inefficiencies. That vector or shared pointer, because they're a single centralized implementation, can be written to be as efficient as possible. And this is actually one of the cool things we're doing in VC9. So, suppose that you've got a vector, a shared pointer, to some x. Okay, and it owns, I guess, maybe 5 elements. Say they store strings or something. Okay. And then you call v.pushback f, or a shared pointer to an x constructor from f. Well, the vector's out of space. It's allocated a memory block of 5 elements. So its capacity is 5. If you try to push back the 6th element into it, it doesn't have space. So what it needs to do is it needs to reallocate. Generally, it will take its current capacity, multiply it by 1.5, so you get maybe 7 or 8 elements. And then what it will do is we'll copy the existing elements over. Nuke the old memory block. And look, now it has space because the capacity equals 7 or whatever it determined. And so, yes, now it can push back your new F. The problem is that the STL likes to copy. That's sort of its biggest performance flaw in C++ 9.8. This is being totally fixed in C++ OX with R value references. But until then, we've got to live with the STL's propensity to copy. C, D, E. And in general, there's no way to avoid this copying of elements from one to the other. If with something like an int, this is okay. There's no faster way to get an int from point A to point B than by copying its bits. Mm. But for objects which are expensive to copy, this can be pretty costly. For example, if you have a vector of vectors, copying all of the subvectors over and then destroying them is inefficient. So if you have a vector of vectors, what the STL will do is, okay, here's your old... vector vectors. I'm sort of simplifying here, but every vector owns chunk of sub-elements. When it reallocates space, so with even more elements, it will say, oh, look here, I've got this old chunk of memory, and I'm moving the contents over to a new chunk of memory. And the keyword is move. Mm-hmm. We don't care what happens to the old chunk of memory, because it's going to be destroyed right after we're done with it. So in VC8, and possibly even earlier, we've got an optimization where STL objects themselves are annotated as having efficient swaps. The cool thing about vectors is, and other STL types, is that they consist of just 3 pointers. Your vector's got like a first pointer, end pointer, and a last pointer. The end pointer points to the one past the end of the elements that are currently filled, and the third pointer points to the actual end of the memory block. You can swap them by simply swapping the pointers without copying any element. So this guy would start owning this block of memory, and this other vector would start owning some other block of memory. You only twiddle the pointers, and you don't have to copy these huge blocks of memory around. So if you reallocate a vector of vectors, the STL implementation will say, oh, look here, I can simply give this guy a pointer to this memory block and so forth, and I'm going to give all these guys null pointers, and I didn't have to allocate or deallocate any of these big chunks of memory, and then this old guy just goes away very fast. So we've actually gone and applied the same swap trick to vector shared pointer. So what would happen if we tried to copy shared pointers now over here? Well, we would need to increment the reference count up to 2 to get them over here, because for a small amount of time, both the old, say this is the A object here, both the old chunk of memory and the new chunk of memory would be owning a single A. So the ref count would go up to 2. Same for all these other guys. And then as soon as we nuke the original chunk of shared pointers, these references go away. So now we've got to go decrement all the reference counts. That takes a lot of time, or more time than I'm prepared to spend when I can so easily avoid it. Mm-hmm. So we've annotated the shared pointer and other STL types as having efficient swaps. Because shared pointer, if you've got an object A here, and this is your shared pointer, what it maintains is 2 pointers. One to the object itself, and another one to a reference count block that might say 1 here. We can swap that over to another shared pointer by simply swapping over the pointers themselves. We don't have to increment the reference counts at all. Mm. So when a vector shared pointer undergoes reallocation, we're going to detect this and say, hey, we're just going to swap these guys. So same semantics, but you don't pay the cost of incrementing and then decrementing those end reference counts.
Excellent. Yeah. What I find here that's interesting is that, in a sense, you're upping the level of abstraction, mm-hmm. Which is what other languages do to a much more extreme way in terms mm-hmm. of managing memory. I mean, in the end...
Well, the thing is, those other languages, they only do it for memory. They say, hey, just nuke up anything, and then you don't have to worry about deleting it. Which has problems if you're the sort of programmer who cares about performance and space efficiency and things like that. And then they don't address non-memory resources at all. They either say, hey, you're on your own, or they say, okay, you're going to have finalizers, but then you need to write custom dispose blocks, which are basically manual resource management. So, yeah, C++ is definitely different there.
Oh, for sure. But, I mean, what I'm saying is it's interesting from an evolutionary perspective that, you know, you are allowing developers. I mean, in the end, it's all about rather than spending time in your algorithm dealing with cleaning its detritus.
Exactly. You can just let it happen automatically. And the thing here is that C++ has automatic resource management where the destructors will hand it all for you with as little overhead as possible. And in fact, directly translating into C code that you could write pretty simply.
Mm-hmm. So do you ever see there being a garbage collected C++?
There are garbage collectors already implemented for C++.
Do they work?
I think the Boeing GC, they've got decades of experience behind them, so they work. And in fact, there was an attempt to add them to C++ OX. That attempt failed and has been cut from the new standard. So we're not going to have a garbage collected standard C++ for at least another decade.
Yeah, I can understand why. It's pretty challenging.
Yeah, it is very challenging, especially in a language like C++. Mm-hmm. And I'm not convinced of how useful it would be. I'm happy to live with the status quo of, hey, you can add a garbage collector to C++ if you want. But especially because things like shared pointer now exist, that satisfies virtually every use I can think of. And in fact, if shared pointer gets cycle collection, where you can make a cycle of shared pointers and then say, hey, go clean up this cycle, that will extend it, its use cases even further, making the range of scenarios in which I could imagine wanting a GC even less. Now, I'm not opposed to GCing specific types, somehow annotating them and having a GC run on just those. But trying to get a GC to look at all the pointers in your program has lots of problems. And those are the problems the committee ran into, and there just wasn't time to hash them all out, given all the other big things they want to do for C++ OX.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about, I've been doing a lot of conversations with language people, and I noticed type traits.
Mm-hmm.
Type is something that's been very interesting recently.
Type traits
let's talk about what that
is. One of
that?
The sort of more specialized, but definitely very useful parts of TR1. So, like, shared pointer is super general. Everyone
Absolutely.
Should be using shared pointer all the time. Regex is very general for anyone doing string manipulation. If you're manipulating strings, you probably could do so more easier with regular expressions. Now, the memfun, functional, and bind additions are good for anyone working with the functional programming part of the STL. But they're not of super wide interest to programmers who aren't doing that sort of thing. Type traits is even more specialized. It's really for programmers who are doing metaprogramming, who are reasoning about types using C++ is a very powerful template mechanism. So what type traits allows you to do is it codifies existing practice. It turns out that after the standard was released and people started writing things like Boost, they kept wanting to do these template tricks and write a whole lot of stuff by hand. Reasoning about types, the type traits then simplifies and also provides the opportunity for compiler hooks. It turns out that there is a few things in C++ that cannot be determined without help of the compiler. They're going to be made a lot easier in C++ OX, but in the time being, we can put all these crazy tricks into a library, and type traits can provide them and give a good enough answer. So you can do things like, okay, I've got a type T, and for some reason, I want to check, okay, is this type a reference? So I can write is reference T value. This will return true if T is actually a X reference, and it will return false if it's like an X pointer or just a plain old X. You can have things like is const, is the type const T? Is it volatile? Is it an array? Is it a function? Is it a pointer? And then you can do transformations on types. So you can take a type T, and you can say, I want to remove pointer T type. And if this is template on T, you'll need to say type name out here. And so if T is actually an X pointer, then this construct will be simply X. If T is anything else, like a K or maybe a K reference, it's just going to remain the same. the transformation doesn't affect it. You can add pointer, you can remove an add const, remove an add volatile, and things like that. And this is useful if you're writing templates that need to work with types in a very general fashion. It's hard to immediately state a use case for these like you can with shared pointer, but the programmers who will want to use type traits can immediately think of places in their code where they've had to write constructs like this, and they've either had to write the little structs themselves to do it, or they've had to rely on Boost or other solutions like that.
Interesting. So the mem function, you briefly touched that. I am kind of very interested in knowing about a little bit more about functional programming in C++, because C++ is an imperative language.
Well, so imperative is one of its paradigms, because remember, it's imperative, which is things like, you know, if, blah, blah, and do some other stuff.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, object-oriented. This is, you know, public base. I also like to break this open and say it supports data encapsulation.